our next guide works much of the year from his home base in Paris, taking American visitors around France. But he's also discovered the magnetic appeal of the cities and countryside of the former French colonies of Indochina, what we call today Southeast Asia. And more American travelers are discovering what the region has to offer, since the sting of the Vietnam War now is more than a generation behind us. Julian Brown joins us next for an overview from Vietnam to Cambodia and Laos. Plus, Julian talks about using nearby Thailand as a base, and what you'll find in Burma now that the tourism boycott has been lifted. Julian, thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
So, I know you're passionate about guiding people around France. How did you get hooked on Southeast Asia?
I suppose really by accident. It'll sound strange, but I went to Vietnam by accident in the early 90s and have never looked back. Been going there ever since.
Well, what are the highlights for travelers in Southeast Asia? I mean, you think about the marquee sites, the temples and so on, but what really grabs you when you're in Southeast Asia?
I think perhaps first and foremost, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the colors, the people, the bustling markets, the street life, as well, of course, as the great temple sites you talked about.
It's a fantasy land for a traveler, really.
Yeah, I agree. I think for a traveler from America or from Europe, it is a fantasy land in many ways, that everything is different. It's, again, the colors, the sights, the sounds, the smells.
Now, if you think about Southeast Asia, is it cohesive in a way? I mean, are there strands that tie it all together? How diverse is it? I mean, if you understand Burma, does that mean you understand Thailand?
Yes and no. You say, is it cohesive? It's a question that's been debated in academic circles for years. Southeast Asia is a construct. I believe historically it was a Second World War construct in terms of military operations. That part of Asia needed to have a label, so it was labeled Southeast Asia. Ever since, people have argued about its cohesion or not. At one time, Bangladesh was included in Southeast Asia. I believe a country like Sri Lanka should be included in Southeast Asia. Not geographically, but because of the influence these countries have. So are they cohesive? They have certain things in common, but never all of them. Most of Southeast Asia was colonized, not all. Thailand was never colonized. Most of Southeast Asia has had a strong Indian influence, where Indian languages and cultures, ancient languages and cultures and religions have come in from the south. You have Hinduism in parts of Southeast Asia, historically,
really? Historically
and today. Yeah. Vietnam is an exception. Vietnam is the part of Southeast Asia that had a Chinese influence. The Chinese influence came down from the north. So hence the French colonial name was Indochina, the land that was halfway between India and China.
Now you said Sri Lanka should be in some ways considered part of Southeast Asia. Geographically, it just fell off the bottom of India. Is that because there's a lot of Buddhism in Sri Lanka?
Exactly. Buddhism died out in India very early on, and Sri Lanka was in a way a filter where Buddhism came from India into Sri Lanka and traveled there by sea routes to Southeast Asia.
It seems to me it's, from a tourism point of view, it's evolving. I mean, back in the 80s, my impression was Thailand was the great place. In the 90s, Vietnam became kind of the new Thailand. In the last decade, Cambodia, now even Burma, getting more tourism. How do you see tourism evolving and changing in Southeast Asia?
Enormously. I think you put them in the right order, that Thailand was the backpacker's paradise in the 70s and 80s. Then, as you say, people started, the intrepid travelers began to enter into Vietnam, I think at the very end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, as the country began to open up. The opening up of Cambodia came after the Khmer Rouge and the Troubles later on. And then Siem Reap, which is the frontier town close to the Angkor Temple complex, has exploded in the last 10 years. Especially when direct flights opened directly into Siem Reap from abroad, before you had to go via Phnom Penh. So Cambodia has seen an explosion of tourism, but in certain locations.
What do you predict now? What is unfolding now?
That process is continuing in Vietnam and Cambodia, and to a certain extent in Laos, where the opening up came a little bit later. And now in Burma, we've seen extraordinary political things happening.
In the past, I know people were almost boycotting Burma because they didn't want to support the military regime there. Is there any political incorrectness for people helping the Myanmar or Burmese economy by going there as tourists?
Yes and no. People were not almost boycotting. A lot of people were boycotting.
Right.
Because Aung San Suu Kyi had asked people not to visit Myanmar. That boycott is now being lifted, and it seems it's a better thing to travel to Myanmar. Having said that, anyone who travels to a country with a complicated regime is somehow financing that regime.
You have to struggle with that in your own mind because in some ways you're helping a bad regime economically. On the other hand, you're making connections to the free world, and that's quite valuable even if you're stoking the economy of a bad regime.
Absolutely. And in terms of bad regimes or regimes we don't like, if I refuse to travel to any country I don't like, I wouldn't go to many countries in the world probably in terms of regimes. Myanmar sadly has a particularly bad regime, but it seems to be very, very slowly at the beginnings of opening up. I say that tentatively.
So as a tour guide, you take groups from Europe to Southeast Asia. How do you try to shape your impact so it's more positive and less negative?
That's a very interesting question. I tend to let the tourists themselves do it. I don't want to influence them. We discuss a lot questions of where they should be spending their money, whether it's possible to frequent local stores, local people, to avoid government-run hotels, for instance. There are very difficult questions about how much money we should pay to children on the streets, to beggars, whether we should fund organizations. So very often I have groups who will want to give a donation to a hospital, visit a hospital or to an orphanage.
Right.
Fund physically money rather than handing it out in the street, to fund it to organizations who will use it.
As a tour guide and a teacher and a leader of travelers, that seems to be a very positive thing. It's just let these little children on the street pull your heartstrings and mm-hmm. collect that compassion and that concern, but then channel it into something that might be a little more constructive.
I think so. I prefer channeling through something constructive. Having right. said that, in the back of my mind, I know that if we give a dollar to someone who has nothing,
it makes a huge difference. That's a day's wages for his dad, probably.
I tend to think, yes, that's the problem. If you give it to a tiny child, the dad may think, well, I'm not going to work anymore. Let the child go and get money off these dumb tourists. So these are very difficult questions.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Southeast Asia with Julian Brown. Julian, a lot of Americans really have a tough time getting comfortable with a war-torn part of the globe after the war is over. And there's a lot of very difficult and bloody recent history in Southeast Asia. What are the scars of the killing fields, of the Vietnam War, the image that local people would have of Americans and so on, that an American dreaming about going to Southeast Asia should be mindful of?
I want to say the scars now are almost tourist scars, superficial scars. I first went to Vietnam in the very early 90s, and when I returned to Europe, everyone said, what was it like? And I knew their question was about the war. That was all the outside world knew about the war. And I had to point out that war had ended.
The Vietnam War.
Yes, yeah. The Vietnam War, which, of course, in Vietnam is called the American War, because
the
they can't call
war.
It the Vietnam War.
So that that's true,
people.
Isn't it? Yeah.
But that war had ended a decade and a half earlier. The scars have gone, and I think Southeast Asia, the people of Southeast Asia, have an incredible talent to get up and move on. And in Vietnam, it took some time. It was a very difficult period immediately after the end of the war. But very quickly from the 90s onwards, they got up and carried on with their lives, and the war was a piece of history.
So when did the Vietnam War finally finish?
April 1975.
So it's been a generation now.
Yeah.
Half of the people in Vietnam have no living memory of the Vietnam War.
It has a very large young population, so most of them weren't even born.
What sort of residual effect is there for Americans walking through the streets of Hanoi?
Almost none in the streets of Hanoi.
Almost none.
The traces of the war in Vietnam are now in many, many war cemeteries all around the country.
Right.
But they aren't necessarily visited by tourists. Some war museums, and then certain places that have been preserved or reconstructed to represent the war, in particular the tunnels, the Kuchi tunnels outside Saigon.
So there's sites in Vietnam that are the American war sites.
They are now tourist attractions.
Tourist attractions.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Julian Brown about Southeast Asia. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Esther's on the line in Chicago. Esther, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you, Rick, for this opportunity to ask a question. I've had the pleasure of traveling in Vietnam. I enjoyed it very much. I'd like to return and visit the Sapa region in northern Vietnam because I enjoy visiting the tribal areas and visiting with minority groups and their markets. So my question is, what's a good time of the year to go to northern Vietnam? And also, how long would you recommend to stay in the area to really enjoy it?
Hi, Esther. What a great question. And can I congratulate you on your good taste for liking Vietnam? And I really want to say, how long should you stay there? Go and stay a lifetime there. No, seriously, the best time for visiting northern Vietnam is generally thought to be in our winter, so November or December. Having said that, there never is an ideal time. The weather can be perfect that time of year. Coming into December and early January, Hanoi can have a very, very light, cold rain all day long. And when you travel up to Sapa, it's almost impossible to predict what the weather will be like because you're going so high. So in terms of the length of time you asked about, I would suggest give yourself a minimum of 3 days in Sapa. I have been there and discovered fog so thick I couldn't see my hands in front of me. And I had to wait 24 hours for the weather to clear. So in order not to have disappointment, give yourself enough days that if the weather is bad, you can sit by a log fire and wait.
So do you feel 3 days would be enough to do a little bit of hiking, visiting the markets, visiting the different minority villages?
I think 3 days would be a good length of time, yeah, especially if you're on a short trip.
So we're talking about Sapa, S-A-P-A, that's a region?
It's a French colonial hill town up in the mountains in northern Vietnam, near the border with
and
China.
And from Hanoi, you would go north? How far and how would you get up there?
Most people now do it by bus or train. There is a special train that goes from Hanoi, a night train, so you can sleep on the train. So it's an all-night train journey, and then you have a bus journey when you get off the train.
So it's about a 10-hour journey north of Hanoi?
Something like that, yeah, perhaps a little bit more than that.
But that's where you would complement the big city and the sort of classic countryside experience.
And as Esther rightly points out, it's a place where people go to see the different ethnic minorities who live in the mountains.
It's like when people go to Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand.
So if you
enjoyed Chiang Mai and that whole dimension of Thailand, you'd want to go to the north hill towns of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Esther, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. And when we think about Vietnam, Hanoi comes to mind. What is it, 4 million people in Hanoi?
Oof, I think 4 million in the center of Hanoi. It's probably three times as much if we take the greater
Hanoi.
Does
it feel that way, or is it kind of overwhelming, or what does it feel like?
I think it feels that way in every street in Hanoi, especially in the old quarter. I think most people who go there for the first time are overwhelmed by the number of motorbikes, the sheer numbers of people in the streets.
Do you enjoy Hanoi?
I love Hanoi.
Why? Take us on a walk down the street.
I knew you'd ask that. Why do I love Hanoi? It's I live in France, as you said, and I think Hanoi is a combination of Paris and Aix-en-Provence. And for people who don't know Aix-en-Provence, it's a beautiful leafy town down in the south of France. Hanoi is an enormous city with all these millions of people.
It's got lakes and tree-lined streets and
it
parks.
It has tree-lined streets everywhere, colonial buildings. It has an extraordinary old quarter called the 36th Street Quarter, which is the old merchant's quarter of tiny streets. Traditionally, each one had its own profession.
Was it destroyed in the war and rebuilt like a lot of cities in Europe?
No, it survived. The old quarter survived reasonably well. What was destroyed in the French period was the walls. It used to be a walled town. Now only one gate remains.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Julian Brown about exploring Southeast Asia. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Gus is calling us from Nashville, Tennessee. Gus, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you for taking it. I wanted to ask what we should see in Phuket.
We've
been to James Bond Island. In fact, we've been in Southeast Asia more than once, so we know a little bit about it, but from a cruise ship. And I'm still on a cruise ship, just wondering if there's anything in Phuket that I needed to see.
Hi, Gus. Well, if you've seen James Bond Island, then you have an idea of the physical natural beauty of that area.
Yes.
Phuket is a tourist island, as I'm sure you know, that has fabulous beaches. It has tourist towns where there's nightlife galore, where you can go from a beer bar to an international cabaret like a Las Vegas cabaret.
Uh-huh.
You can, if you're on your cruise ship, you could get off and go on a classic elephant ride, but you may have already done that. You can go and see temples, go to the old town of Phuket and see old colonial architecture.
Okay.
So there's a mixture of things you can do. You probably won't have that much time if you're on a cruise ship.
No.
Or you might just want to enjoy one of the fabulous beaches on Phuket.
But I enjoyed your comments about Vietnam. Ha Long Bay was the most beautiful place I've seen. I was very surprised.
I wanted to talk about Ha Long Bay because I hear so much about that. Julian, tell us about this. What is it, like 3,000 islands?
I mean, yeah, I've never counted them, but it's a lot of islands. It's an extraordinary bay with limestone rock formations that come out. And you can take boats and go in amongst these extraordinary limestone formations. Many people know it from the famous French film Indochine that came out with Catherine Deneuve in the early 1990s, which was probably one of the best travelogues Vietnam had ever seen. And it's a World Heritage Site. It's classified by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site.
I was reading that Ho Chi Minh appreciated it. He said, in his linguistic flair, the wonder one cannot impart to others. I guess it's, you got to see it to believe it, huh?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely.
It just sounds like it's this sort of utopian mix of jungle and exotic beaches and coral reefs and almost no human impact. It survives quite well to this day.
That's correct. And a beautiful cave there, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Gorgeous caves.
Well, Gus, thanks for your call and happy travels.
All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
We'll wrap things up just with a real quick review. I mean, we've got like 5 countries in Southeast Asia. I know this is ridiculous, but give us just a little, in a few sentences, a thumbnail swing through each country, how it distinguishes itself from the others. Thailand?
Thailand, I suppose, is the country in Southeast Asia that opened up to tourists earliest, so it has a very organized tourist structure. Most people fly to Southeast Asia via Bangkok Airport.
That'd be the starting point for a Southeast Asian
trip.
It's
the starting point and the stopping off point for lots of people in Southeast Asia.
What about Laos? We didn't talk about Laos much.
Laos is perhaps the country, along with Myanmar and mainland Southeast Asia, which is the least opened up to tourism. And so it's a beautiful, very laid back.
So if you
want to
be
country,
an adventure and get there before the crowds do, Myanmar or Burma and Laos would be the places to go?
Probably now in Southeast Asia, yes.
Yeah. Cambodia?
Cambodia has opened up enormously since the end of the troubles in the Khmer Rouge and receives millions of visitors because of the great Angkor Wat temple complex.
And then what about Vietnam?
Vietnam has always been my favorite country in Southeast Asia, and it's an extraordinary country. The whole of the world thinks of Vietnam as a war. People say, what did you do after Vietnam, as if it's not even a place? And I think everyone who goes there discovers it's a fairly extraordinary place of natural beauty, of extraordinary people, of fascinating culture, a mixture of China from the north and Southeast Asia from the south.
Now, if you were to gather one image and share it with us on how Southeast Asia really is, take us there just to wrap up this interview.
I think I'd go back to Ha Long Bay we were talking about earlier and imagine sitting at sunset on a boat in the middle of the most extraordinary natural landscape imaginable, eating fabulous fresh caught seafood.
Nice.
What could be better than that?
I don't know. Julian Brown, thanks so much for giving us an insight into Southeast Asia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Forte e gentile.
Wait, did you hear that?
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington. Thanks to Jim Richards at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and to Robin Cronin, Andrew Wakeling, Jonathan Lee, and Chris Luzik for technical help. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. There's more in the radio section of ricksteves.com, including links to our guests, and a phone app with interviews from the show, and guided walking tours by Rick to many of Europe's most popular sites. Look for the Rick Steves Audio Europe package at ricksteves.com. And join us again next week for more Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves is made possible in part by the European Union delegation to the USA. The European Union received the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize for promoting peace, human rights, and democracy. Information available at euintheus.org.